The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
And that means understanding what our adversaries do, what their cyber capabilities are, what their capabilities are in how they can track us and sense us and understand what we're doing. And then to develop countermeasures to that. And some of them are, you know, quite pedestrian, and some of them are high tech. And, you know, so years from now, there'll be another movie that that gets produced that looks at this. But that's, it was not easy, you know, during, you know, the 1970s to operate on the streets of Moscow. They were photographing us and recording us and trying, you know, the ways to keep track of what we're doing, you know. And we figured out then how to continue to do our work, and we are figuring it out now as well.
I'm David Chris.
And I'm Brian Cunningham, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 1st, May Day, 2023.
David Cohen is Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, a position he held also during the Obama administration. He's also been Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence in the Department of the Treasury and a partner at the WilmerHale Law Firm.
We talk with David about his career, including taking the same job twice, the coming debate about the FISA Amendments Act reauthorization, relationships between CIA and other U.S. government elements, particularly in cyber, the new CIA Mission Center for Transnational and Technology, and the strategic competition between the United States and the People's Republic of China.
The discussion with David continues our series of discussions with U.S. cyber leaders, including Chris Inglis, Kemba Walden, Jen Easterly, Rob Joyce, Chris Fonzone, and Laura Galante of ODNI.
It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 1st. David Cohen, Deputy Director of the CIA.
You're the Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, a job that you are doing for the second time. But yes, you're trained as a lawyer, not a spy. And so can you just tell our audience how you ended up in this role?
I mean, the truth is I did not expect to be the Deputy Director of the CIA even one time, much less twice. But I am quite happy to be in this role. And, I mean, as you noted, I trained as a lawyer. You know, I always had a latent interest in national security, dating back to, you know, my college days. But I had, you know, spent about 20 years in private practice before I got into really into government. And I went to the Treasury Department in 2009, in the part of the Treasury Department that was created post 9/11 to deal with national security issues, anti-money laundering and sanctions in particular, but also all the policy issues that sort of surrounded those topics. And I spent 6 years at Treasury working on our sanctions programs, in particular, our counter-terrorist financing, a lot of the sanctions involving Iran, North Korea, the first invasion by Russia of Ukraine, other issues like that. And, you know, and got some introduction to the intel community in that capacity. There is a small intel unit at the Treasury Department that does analysis that that I had the pleasure of overseeing. And then in end of 2014, had a phone call sort of out of the blue from Director John Brennan, who asked me if I would be interested in coming over to be the deputy director of CIA. And, you know, I jumped at the chance. It was a great opportunity. I came over, spent the last 2 years of the Obama administration as the deputy director, working with Director Brennan. You know, was a fantastic opportunity to really sort of immerse myself in what the CIA does and get to really understand some of the extraordinary things that the women and men of CIA do. And I was having a terrific time doing that. But then there was an election and I got tossed out of my job along with a bunch of other people. So I went out into the wilderness for 4 years, back to practicing law. But then, you know, the opportunity arose to come back and do this again. And, you know, I so enjoyed those 2 years that I had with Director Brennan, and was, you know, eager to link up with Bill Burns, who's now the director, and back with the folks at CIA and really the extraordinary mission. And so I leapt at the chance to come back in. And so I've now been back for a little over 2 years, doing it again, trying to get it right this time.
Well, David, let me drill down on that for a second, because we're lawyers who have also served in policy positions, and a lot of our listeners are lawyers who may be thinking about policy positions. And I had a career at the agency, and I served in operations and analysis, and as a lawyer and as a manager. And I remember one of my bosses one time, Steve Hadley, who was also a lawyer, telling me, listen, you're the lawyer, not the client. Keep it that way. And so I'm curious about how you make that transition back and forth, how you view your lawyers when you're a client, and how you view your clients when you're a lawyer. I think that's interesting to our viewers, our listeners.
Yeah, well, I have never been a lawyer in the national security community. So I've never had that opportunity to advise on national security issues. I've always been on the client side. And look, first of all, I have great lawyers. The general counsel of CIA now and the last time I did this are both extraordinary lawyers. And whenever I veer into thinking that I can analyze a legal issue or provide legal advice, I'm quickly reminded that I should stick on the policy side. You know, so I think it doesn't really become a problem. And the other thing I would say, you know, for all the lawyers out there who are interested in potentially serving as a lawyer in the national security community, what I think is really interesting about that role, and you should feel free to agree or disagree with this, is that there are interesting, hard legal issues, actual legal issues. But then there are, you know, any number of sort of difficult problems to sort through that are sort of within the boundaries of the law. So you're not butting up against the guardrails, but you're trying to figure out what's the best, smartest, most effective thing to do within the confines of what is, you know, legally permissible. And, you know, and I look to our lawyers to, you know, to provide advice and counsel as we think through those hard questions as well. And I think that is pretty typical for lawyers in the national security community.
Well, and so much of your job as a lawyer in that environment involves cases of first impression. You can't go find a statute or a case or an executive order provision that actually answers the question, which can sometimes be life or death. So that's a feature and maybe a bug, depending on your personality.
Yeah, right. I mean, there are precedents, for lack of a better word, in the national security space, whether it's OLC opinions or memos written by agency general counsel, or just, you know, the practice that has grown up over the years and how you deal with similar problems. But you're right. There are questions that come along, and frankly, that's part of what makes this job so interesting and so enjoyable. There are questions that come along every week that, you know, we have not confronted before that aren't, again, they aren't sort of hardcore legal questions that come up, but they are questions about how the agency ought to operate that involve, you know, difficult considerations, some that are informed by the statutes that created the CIA, but mostly are informed by how we've understood our role and our responsibilities over the years.
So, David, how do you assess the culture of legalism and respect for law and the role of lawyers there? I mean, personally, first of all, did you experience, you know, organ rejection when you showed up as the deputy the first or maybe the second time? And second, more generally, you know, John Rizzo, by way of example, used to say that the ops, you know, ops people would want very much to get the advice of the lawyers, and that it was, if anything, they would sometimes, you know, self-inhibit. Is that your perception as well, that that legalism has very, very strongly infused the agency, or what are you seeing in that regard?
Yeah. So look, I came to the agency, you know, after, you know, 20 years of the practice of law and, you know, the 6 years at Treasury, not knowing what to expect about how lawyers are integrated into the agency's activities. When I came into the agency, I saw really quickly how much the lawyers are involved, you know, up and down the organization every step of the way. So there are, you know, lawyers who are there to advise the director and the deputy director on a daily basis, but out in the mission centers, you know, in the directorates, there are lawyers that are, you know, forward deployed and part of the team. And they are, I think, exactly as John Rizzo indicated, they are relied upon, you know, to be part of the formulation of whether it's the operation, the technical operation that we're doing, whatever the issue is that is being confronted. Lawyers are part of the process, and you know, I think it's a credit, frankly, to, you know, many years of lawyers in the agency and my predecessors in making sure that connection between the lawyers and their clients is one that is, I think, quite natural now in the agency.
Yeah, that's a real cultural change. I was around in the 80s and the 90s, and there was a time when you sort of had to spend a lot of time and effort winning the trust of your client to get them to tell you anything. And that all changed during the 90s. And I think it's pretty dramatically different now, which is to the good, I think.
Yeah, it is definitely, if that's the way it was, it has changed. You know, I think there's a appreciation, you know, broadly across the agency for the role of the lawyers in helping us, you know, sort through these difficult issues and, frankly, you know, keeping us out of trouble.
Yeah. So let's go over to the nominal subtopic of our podcast, which is cyber. I mean, CIA obviously is known primarily as a human intelligence collection agency focused on that, but it is actually involved in cyber issues pretty heavily. And in fact, you recently added the new Mission Center for Transnational and Technology, which was on top of the Directorate for Digital Innovation that had existed and was created during your last tour. So tell us about how CIA plays in the cyberspace.
So let me just take a little bit of a step back, because I think understanding how CIA plays in the cyberspace and what we do with respect to cyber makes sense if you understand sort of more broadly how we approach issues of technology. So I hope your listeners appreciate it. Technology, you know, is core to what the agency does and has done, you know, since its founding. You know, from the very get-go, we have had a Directorate of Science and Technology that, you know, is responsible for, you know, developing, you know, the gadgets. I mean, the line that I've heard is they do everything from mascara to satellites, right? They have over the years, you know, developed, you know, whether it's alias documents or various ways to
microphones hidden in martini olives, poison tipped umbrellas, all kinds of nifty stuff that you've
seen. Yeah, ways to hide things on the streets of Moscow. You know,
there's all rocks.
In our museum, there is a what looks to all the world like a dead rat. But what it is was a dead drop. It was, you know, there was a zipper hidden in that what looks like the dead rat that you could hide a document in and, you know, leave outside for your asset to pick up, and the asset could then put information in it. So, you know,
also an implied warning against becoming a double agent. What happens to rats?
Hashtag rat zipper.
The point is, we have embraced technology from the founding of the agency now, 76 years ago, and have partnered with the private sector in developing, cool technology over the years as well. So, the A-12 spy plane, something that the agency developed with private industry. Google Earth, people may not know, that was the product of essentially a joint venture between the agency and a private company to do 3D mapping, and eventually got commercialized. So over a long time, we have helped develop technology, and we have adopted technology in doing our business. We have collection that's powered by technology, and we have also been called upon, to analyze foreign technological developments, often military, but also other sorts of technology. And so that has been, sort of baked into the DNA of the agency, from the beginning. But I think in the last, 10 years, as the revolution in technology has accelerated, we have also, upped our game on technology. So as you mentioned, back in 2015, we created a new directorate at the agency. And these are sort of the big building blocks of how the agency does its work. So we have a director of science and technology that has been around for a long time, a director of operations that oversees our overseas espionage activities, director of analysis that does the analytic work, director of support that makes it so that the agency can operate both here and overseas. And we created something called the Directorate of Digital Innovation, which was focused on, as its name suggests, the digital domain and cyber. And it in part brought together the disparate parts of the agency that were focused on digital issues, on cyber issues, and in part also created the platform for us to do more in those areas. And within DDI, the Director of Digital Innovation, we have something called the Center for Cyber Intelligence, or CCI. That is where that's sort of the heart of our cyber activity in the agency. And it does, the sort of the cyber offense work, essentially, our collection, cyber enabled collection on what folks are involved in. And it does cyber defense, for the agency. We have cyber networks that need to be defended, and they're responsible for that. And they also work with others around the agency doing cyber analysis, so analyzing what our adversaries are doing in the cyber domain. And then they also do what I would call sort of cyber adjacent work in DDI. So our open source center is in the Director of Digital Innovation. So the folks who look at, overseas open source information to try and, as a one of the sources of intelligence that we rely upon to do our analysis. I guess the last piece I would say in DDI is we also have in there the Office of Cybersecurity. So our agency, Chief Information Security Officer is there, and the folks who work with him to ensure the security of our systems, like any other, federal agency, we're subject to those rules and regulations, and we take really seriously our own personal sort of cyber hygiene and cyber defense.
This is a little bit of a one-off, David, and obviously you probably can't answer in great detail, but I've been thinking a lot about how an intelligence agency could possibly maintain cover of officers serving undercover overseas in the modern world. I mean, even before GPT chat and the like, that must be a huge challenge for you right now.
It is a challenge. The way that we think about this is, there's now digital dust that everybody sort of leaves behind in what they do. And we need to be mindful of that as we operate undercover overseas, what the digital footprint is of our officers, both, frankly, before they go overseas and when they're overseas.
Sure.
And we train to that. This is something that we're well aware of. And so we manage our officers' digital footprint. But the other piece of that is, this we live in an era of, you know, ubiquitous technical surveillance or ubiquitous sensing in many places around the world. You know, not just in, you know, Beijing or Moscow, but there are, you know, lots and lots of cities around the world that are adopting, you know, smart city, you know, approaches where there are cameras everywhere. You know, there are license plate readers. There's, you know, just a whole host of ways to identify what people are doing. And that, you know, frankly, makes it harder for us to operate in the way that we have traditionally operated, which is, you know, to, you know, you've seen these all in the spy movies, you know, we'll wear a disguise, you know, we'll take a circuitous route to a meeting with an asset. You know, that is, you know, under stress in a world where, you know, if you have a cell phone in your pocket, you know, you're every, you know, half meter, you're being tracked.
You can run a hell of an SDR, but if they're just tracking you, really, it's not
exactly
that useful, right?
Yeah.
I'm almost inclined to discredit the Nolan brothers with the lack of imagination and person of interest, and that was only 10 years ago.
Right. I mean, the march of technology is something else, right? So, look, we have always been confronted with the need to get ahead of the means and mechanisms that our adversaries are using to try and, you know, and track us down. So that's why we had disguises, why we had alias docs. That's why we, you know, do SDRs. And, you know, now, you know, what we're doing is we're evolving our tradecraft to address the technical challenge that comes from ubiquitous technical surveillance or other ways that that the digital era makes our work more challenging. And that means understanding what our adversaries do, what their cyber capabilities are, what their capabilities are in how they can track us and sense us and understand what we're doing. And then to develop countermeasures to that. And some of them are, you know, quite pedestrian, and some of them are high tech. And, you know, so years from now, there'll be another movie that that gets produced that looks at this. But it was not easy, you know, during, you know, the 1970s to operate on the streets of Moscow. They were photographing us and recording us and trying, you know, the ways to keep track of what we're doing, you know. And we figured out then how to continue to do our work. And we are figuring it out now as well.
Fair. Well, so moving from the fantastical to the hopefully sublime, our open source intelligence collection tells us that you and your spouse were at South by Southwest recently. How was that?
It was great. It was great. You know, we went to South by Southwest. Yeah, I think it was the first time the agency had been there. But we went, you know, basically for two reasons. One is the same reason that I'm doing this podcast, which is that I think we have an obligation as a secret intelligence service in a democracy to explain ourselves, to talk to, you know, the American people about what we do.
I thought you were going to say it was because of
very cool people,
charm and good looks.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that kind of hurts a little bit.
That was the second reason. No, I mean, look, I think it's incumbent on the leaders of the agency to get out and to talk about what we do as best we can. There are obviously limits on that, but there are also things that we can talk about and that we should talk about so that, you know, frankly, so the American people understand what their CIA is doing. I think that's just, it's part of what we should do as public servants. So we went to South by Southwest, and I go, and Director Burns and others in the agency go to, you know, a whole variety of venues to talk about, you know, what the agency is doing. South by Southwest gets us access to a slightly different slice of America.
Are you recruiting cyber talent at South by Southwest?
Well, so that was the second reason. So
okay.
Look, that in fact is the second reason we were there is we are all in on upping our game on issues having to do with technology. South by Southwest is, you know, apart from the really cool musical acts, it is also a place where there's a lot of folks who are involved in technology, in new and emerging technology, you know, and are folks who we are interested in talking to, both because we want to recruit talent. There are a lot of, you know, folks who are there who are looking for a career in technology, and we are making the case that you can come work for the CIA and scratch that itch. And we're also on the lookout for companies that we might want to work with who have technology that we could use in our operations. You know, from exquisite operations to running our business processes. Right? I mean, we are a big operation. So we went to South by Southwest really for those two reasons. And I had a great time. It was a terrific venue to talk about what we do and to interact with folks on the floor.
Well, also, who knows when you might need to break out that Argo tradecraft again. Got to keep those connections up.
Yeah, you know, we are an agency that's got a lot of irons in the fire at all the time.
A young person or a youngish person and you're interested in applying, CIA can be a little daunting. You know, you guys are scary and so forth, but the mission might be appealing to some. You know, do you have any, I guess, advice to a young person, particularly if maybe they've smoked dope or something once or twice, you know, how and whether they should, seek you out?
Yeah. So you should stop before you apply. That's my first piece of advice. Although it is not as preclusive as it used to be, but you should stop. But in all seriousness, we are making it easier to apply to work at the agency. It used to be that you'd go on the website, there was a long application that you needed to fill out. We have moved to a system now where you submit a resume.
So kind of like a normal job.
Kind of like a normal job.
You guys are doing great modernization.
Exactly. And, you know, we take a look at the resume, and if it looks like someone that we might be interested in, then we reach out and contact you, and the process moves forward. So the sort of the barrier to entry has been lowered. If you're interested in the agency, basically drop a resume. And we're also doing a whole host of other things to make that process from application to onboarding faster and, frankly, to modernize it. It's more online now than it used to be, and it goes much more quickly. And one of the problems that we inherited when Director Burns and I came in was a just extraordinarily long period between application to people coming on board, and that not surprisingly was a real impediment to our ability to attract the talent that we want in the agency. We would lose people as they were waiting and waiting and waiting to come on board. It still is not, I think, quite as fast as, you know, some private sector jobs, but we are driving down the timeline to something that is much more reasonable and much more, you know, commensurate with what you would find in the private sector. You know, and in doing that, I think becoming an easier employer for folks to find their way into.
Okay, great. I'm just going to give one free piece of advice for people applying, which is, for God's sake, don't lie in the background investigation. Whatever you did, if it's too much, they'll not hire you. But if you lie, they have absolutely no sense of humor whatsoever about that. And that's where you can get into some very bad consequences. So just tell the truth.
Let me reinforce that for especially our younger generation. I myself passed 4 polygraphs for 4 different jobs. I told the truth every time. And believe me, if I got through, you can get through.
Brian's just a shell of a man now. So,
no, I'm serious. The deputy director gave great advice. If you're doing things that might be a problem, stop. But at least in my experience, the fact that in your youth you may have done some of those things is not automatically disqualifying as long as you've cleaned up your act.
Yeah.
Yeah, and tell the truth.
Yeah,
tell the truth.
Tell the truth.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you. Constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
So back to cyber, maybe. I mean, you're the deputy director, and I mean, who are you interacting with in other elements of the government, either the White House or ONCD or you know, NSA? Who are your main counterparts when you engage on cyber in the interagency?
Yeah, so the White House for sure. So both ONCD as well as the, you know, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. And then a lot of interaction as well with NSA and Cybercom in you know, in a variety of different ways. But then, you know, truthfully, the whole conglomeration of agencies that have interest in cyber, you know, in various ways. So, you know, some with the FBI, you know, some with, you know, with CISA, of course, but it's that tends to be a little bit more sporadic.
Yeah. So, you know, this is an old question and a little bit of a joke, but it's interesting your take on it. So, you know, everybody promotes unity of effort. I mean, I think since, well, for a long time in cyber matters, and that's hard because they cross, you know, many silos. Have you assessed that there is pretty good unity of effort across the government right now in matters cyber? And how do we make sense of a call for unity of effort with not one, but two White House cyber organizing entities? Are we getting twice the unity or half the unity from that?
Yeah, I think what I have seen in the cyber domain in the government, and I have, you know, I have this sort of interesting perspective of having done this job for a couple of years, gone away, and now have come back a couple of years later, is that the various elements and that are involved in our cyber, you know, in particular on the cyber defense side and cyber policy side, you know, there's been a little bit of growth, right, with the creation of the, you know, Office of National Cyber Director. But I think more importantly, what I have witnessed is the various elements that have a piece of the cyber pie have developed their particular expertise and have sort of leaned into their authorities, and have, you know, built out their part of the effort. There are overlapping authorities and overlapping expertise. But there's, I think, been more sort of differentiation in the organism, as it were, over the years. And, you know, so I think that there's, you know, to use the, you know, what is probably an overused metaphor, what used to be a little bit of, the 6-year-old soccer game with everybody running around kicking the ball. I think we may not quite be in the Premier League, but we might be, capable of getting upgraded soon to the Premier League.
You heard it here first, David Cohen as Ted Lasso.
Absolutely.
There's been rumint, you know, David, at various times about like the NSC process, the interagency process around cyber operations. And obviously Cyber Command got some new authorities a few years back in the Defense Authorization Act. Some people say that the interagency for approval of cyber operations is sclerotic and choked off. Some people say it's working smooth as silk, and you know, it tends to sort of pendulum back and forth. How do you assess that to the extent you can speak publicly about it? Are we tied up in knots, or are we able to do stuff when we need to without getting gummed to death?
Or both.
Yeah. Look, I think we are much, much better. And yeah, as we have more reps, essentially, we get better at this. I think part of the critique of, you know, things being tied up in knots, I think is a little bit unfair. And I say that because the question about doing, and this is not really the agency's role. I mean, this is me sort of witnessing other parts of the government, but in doing cyber operations, is that it raises difficult issues, policy issues and some legal issues, to go back to, you know, what we're talking about at the outset. And it's in an area that is still new. And there's a lot of, you know, fresh terrain out there that hasn't been well mapped. And figuring out what is the right policy approach requires, you know, some hard conversations and hard decisions to get made. And so I think being deliberate and smart and thoughtful about using, you know, cyber as a tool makes good sense. Now, do we over torque it sometimes? Probably. But is it better than being a bunch of cyber cowboys? Yeah, I think so. And so, I mean, that's what I witness. I mean, I should hasten to add, like, I typically in these sorts of conversations, I am a fly on the wall observing the conversation about others and others, authorities and capabilities. But that's you know, sort of from my vantage point, how these conversations play out.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I mean, you know, the DOD guys will tell you, like, you can do a bomb damage assessment in advance. You know where a kinetic weapon is going to hit and what it'll do. You drop a cyber weapon, it's a little harder to predict what the collateral effects might be.
Yeah.
So it's just a harder analysis, and it's a newer one too, a newer discipline. So that makes sense. So, David, let's pivot to another topic, which is Section 702 of the FISA Reauthorization Act, which, unless it is reauthorized by the Congress, will sunset at the end of this calendar year. CIA and Director Burns and others have been pretty vocal in saying how valuable this authority is to you. Tell us, what is the value proposition for CIA and the government generally around FISA Amendments Act?
And maybe just remind some of our non-geeky listeners what 702 is.
Are there any such listeners? All right.
Sure. Look, I mean, what 702 is a statute enacted by the Congress that allows the government to collect intelligence information on foreign persons outside the United States. There's a whole process and procedure that is spelled out in the statute that requires, oversight by a specialized court that has been established for that purpose. And the executive branch works within the confines of what the court permits pursuant to the statute, and with, I think, quite unusual reporting requirements to Congress. So it is a collection capability directed at foreign persons overseas that is overseen by all three branches of the federal government. And to answer your question directly, David, I think we at the CIA, and I think in the intelligence community more broadly, view the collection that we are able to do pursuant to Section 702 as indispensable to the work that we do in our, in our day jobs and providing, indications and warnings of threatening activities by adversaries so that we can inform the president and senior policymakers of what's happening in the world, what the threats are, and so that they can do their job of defining what our national security and foreign policy ought to be. It allows us to do our, to do that with precision, with speed, while respecting the rights of Americans. And as I said, subject to the oversight of all three branches of the federal government. You asked about the value proposition. So let me give you a couple of examples. I mean, one metric is the president every day gets the presidential daily brief, the PDB. It has in it, a number of articles that describe sort of the most important national security issues that the community, the intelligence community, thinks that the president needs to be aware of. A sizable proportion of the intelligence that goes into the PDB every day comes from 702 collection. So our analysts across the community that are writing for the PDB rely on 702 collection to write the PDB articles. But in terms of, specific examples of the way that 702 has been useful, let me just tick off a couple of them for you. I think in the, in the early days of 702, it was largely focused on the counterterrorism mission. It continues to contribute to that. And in fact, 702 collection contributed to the information that the U.S. government had that allowed us as a government to take the strike against Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was the leader of al-Qaeda, who was living in a safe house in downtown Kabul, last July. 702 collection, contributed to our knowledge that Zawahiri was there. But it's also really important outside of the counterterrorism context. So for instance, 702 has been used to identify foreign ransomware attacks on U.S. critical infrastructure. And, you know, not just one, but multiple attacks have been identified and defended against because of 702 collection. It's been used to identify and protect against other cyber attacks that have been launched or considered coming from China, from Russia, from Iran, from North Korea. It's been used in efforts to prevent U.S. technology being acquired by adversaries for their advanced weapons programs. And it's been used to identify efforts by foreign actors to make surreptitious investments in U.S. Companies, seeking to bypass regulatory scrutiny and, you know, obtain access to intellectual property. It's been used more recently to uncover atrocities committed by Russia in Ukraine, including the murder of non-combatants, the forced relocation of children from Russian-occupied Ukraine to Russia, and the detention of refugees who are trying to flee violence in Ukraine. In the spy business, and, you know, so sort of close to home, you know, 702 has helped us identify when, you know, hostile foreign intelligence services are trying to send their operatives into the United States to recruit spies here in the U.S. It also supports our ability to run safe human intelligence operations abroad by allowing us to gain invaluable insight into our human assets, the individuals who have put their lives on the line to work for the United States. 702 helps us protect them from scrutiny from, you know, from those who would want to do them harm. And finally, and I think importantly, 702 has enabled several recent successes against foreign drug cartels by illuminating their networks and the global supply chains that support them, you know, from China all the way to Mexico, and have facilitated partner government actions against those networks, helping to counter the fentanyl threat. So, you know, sort of across the board, sort of the whole gamut of national security issues that that we focus on, 702 plays a really important role.
Boy, those are really powerful examples, David. And David, Chris follows this more closely than I do. David, you can correct me, but I don't remember anything like that level of specificity being discussed in public the last time the 702 provisions were re-upped. Do you feel able to, without predicting what the Congress is going to do, you know, behind closed doors, in the skiffs on the Hill, sort of prove to the skeptical members of Congress that all these things you just said have happened?
Look, what I can tell you is that the intelligence community, you know, and the White House and the policy community are committed to working with Congress to reauthorize 702, and that includes providing even more detail behind closed doors about the way that 702 is, as I said, indispensable to the work that we do. You know, so I think our commitment is that we're gonna do that work, you know, to make the case that 702, you know, really is something that we need to retain.
So that was a terrific survey of all the affirmative use cases. Very compelling, David. And the last one you mentioned about the drugs and fentanyl in particular, which has been a real scourge. I just want to make sure for the Nerdy Lawfare listeners, you're not trying to say anything radical and new and different about this authority and the way it's been used in terms of sort of broadly reaching general drug crime, but rather something that's interesting and compelling about the use of it within the existing framework. Is that more or less what you're saying?
I think that's a very good way to put it.
Okay. Let me come at it from the other side then. Let's assume, against expectation or at least against hope, that the Congress were to let this sunset. Have you guys done any contingency planning? I mean, do you assess that there are legitimate substitutes that might fill the gap that would otherwise be created? Or really, is this just something that is, in the sense of indispensable, meaning you really couldn't backfill for it in any meaningful way?
Look, I think it would be extraordinarily difficult to backfill. And it would be both difficult and I think less privacy protecting to right. try to backfill, right? The way that we would have to try to backfill this is to hoover up a huge amount of data if we could. And
using 12333 authorities, which are
under 12333 authorities.
Yeah,
exactly.
Not as strongly regulated.
And, you know, and then, you know, try and derive out of that, you know, mass of data, the same, you know, insights that we can get in a much more precise, targeted fashion with 702 collection. And again, I don't suspect that we would be able to, get to the same point where we are in terms of the value that we derive from 702.
And so then just being realistic about the prospects here in the Congress, given the alignment of, you know, two groups of politicians who are questioning this, the sort of traditional left civil liberties crowd and the other newer group on the other side of the spectrum. I mean, are you prepared, and I'm not asking you to do a statement of administration position, but are you being realistic about the kinds of limitations or added protections that might come along with a reauthorization? Probably a lot of those, frankly, are not your ticket because they're more in the FBI space for domestic and non-FI crimes. But I mean, has the agency thought about some ground it could give if that were necessary to get the thing reauthorized?
Well, I guess I would say two things. One is I'm not going to negotiate.
At least not with me right here.
But more seriously, look, I think I see our role at the agency as providing our expert view on the value of 702 and how we use 702. I'm going to leave it to others to do the negotiating with Congress about, you know, any amendments or changes.
Very wise. When I asked a similar question to Matt Olson, I said something like, are you prepared to cut off the finger to save the hand? And he said, well, as a baseline for our hopes and dreams here, we're trying to avoid amputation of anything. So thank you. So your answer is just as good as Matt's.
All right. Well, we're not going to ask you about 702 and China, but we can't let you go without asking about China. So In the interest of time, I would condense what could be 20 questions into 1A and 1B. And 1A is, what do you feel is the most important thing our listeners should know about how the agency and the policy community see the China threat to the United States? And two, are they the single greatest threat to the United States right now and for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, look, I think we view China in the agency, and I think this reflects the broader policy community, as the most significant geostrategic threat facing the United States over the long term. And that is because China presents a challenge in multiple domains. It presents a military challenge, presents an economic challenge, it presents a ideological challenge, it presents a technological challenge. And so I think as we sort of assess the various ways in which, you know, China puts at risk what we care about as the United States, our place in the world, our way of life, our economic security, and our technological development, China is, you know, sort of the number one concern on each of those dimensions. And so within the agency, we have created a mission center, which is sort of the operational elements within the agency that we've organized that is focused specifically on China. So we have a China mission center that is responsible for organizing what we do in the agency, specifically focused on China, in China itself. So, you know, in the, you know, over in, you know, in the Indo-Pacific, but also how we address the threat from China around the world, what we're doing in Latin America, what we're doing in Africa, what we're doing in Europe with respect to the challenge, the competition with China. A lot of what we are focused on is around technology. China has, you know, and Xi Jinping in particular, has declared their intention to surpass the United States as the epicenter of technological development in the world, and to control the key new and emerging technologies that are being developed, whether it's AI or quantum or, you know, new battery technology sort of across the board. And, you know, we're very focused on making sure that we understand what it is that the Chinese are trying to do and how they're trying to do it, and then present to the policy community our best understanding and analysis of the ways in which that challenges, you know, our national security. The other, you know, the other issue that gets a lot of attention for obvious reasons is the military threat that China poses, and in particular the potential that China may move militarily against Taiwan. And so we spend, you know, a lot of time focused on understanding what both military capability is from China, but also importantly intentions and how Xi Jinping is thinking about achieving what he says quite clearly he wants to achieve, which is to bring Taiwan, you know, completely under the control of Beijing before, you know, his term expires as the leader of China. I think it remains our assessment that he would prefer to do that without engaging in military conflict. But we are, you know, we're obviously quite attentive to how Xi Jinping is trying to effectuate that goal. So anyway, that's a very short version of what is a quite consuming effort in the agency and across the IC.
So, David, thank you very much for your spending time with us and for your terrifically insightful and candid answer. It's been great having you. We really appreciate it.
And your public service. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I really enjoyed it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare.
You'll get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. And check out our written work at lawfareblog.com.
The podcast is edited by Jen Patcha Howell, and your audio engineer for this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.